Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey guys, hope you're having a great day wherever you're tuning in from. We appreciate you coming to the show. Today, I got a great one for you where I welcome Dr. Margaret Chisholm, and she is the Vice Chair for Education and Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences in Medicine at Johns Hopkins. She received her BA in Visual Arts from UMBC and her MD from the University of Maryland. And she has authored over 100 scientific, clinical, and medical educational papers on psychiatric disorders and humanistic medical practice, as well as articles and one book on the use of social media in medicine and two books on psychiatry. And today we talk about one of her books, her latest book, From Survive to Thrive. And we dig into what it means to just be surviving and how we get towards thriving in this life. And we talk about, you know, dealing with mental illness, depression, some actionable things that you can do to try to dig yourself out of that, and also how to retell your life narrative, your life story. I think that's a really valuable one for me lately. I've realized that the voice in my head a lot of times is negative and is not really telling me the objective reality of what's going on. And I totally relate to that and think it's really important when you can start to understand that that's not the reality, that little voice, that inner critic, whatever it is. And when we start to observe that and realize that that's not us, we can gain more control and move through the world in a lot better way. So Dr. Chisholm tells us how to do that. And I refer to her as Meg in the interview, as she has asked me to do. So don't think that we go back 20 years and I'm super casual, but she is cool and likes to go by Meg. So you know that. And as always, we appreciate you guys tuning in, subscribing to the show, and telling your friends and family, and leaving those 5-star reviews. That really helps us spread the word and continue to bring you these episodes. And if you like this show, or if you're a longtime listener and you haven't left a review, get in there. It takes a couple minutes. We really do appreciate that. All right, guys, enjoy today's episode. Hi, Meg. Thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Oh, thanks. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Today, we're going to talk about your book, From Survive to Thrive. And I thought a good place to start would be having you tell our listeners the distinction between and just what it means to just be surviving and then thriving.
Yeah, thanks. I was thinking about the title for the book and thought that survive to thrive would be a great concept, because so many people with psychiatric problems, actually, these are life and death problems, right? If you're depressed, you have a risk of suicide. If you are have an eating disorder, you're at risk of dying from starvation. So there's all kinds of psychiatric problems that have a high rate of mortality and a risk of death. So the first step is to survive your psychiatric problem. And the next step is to go from languishing to flourishing. So, you know, when you're just getting over psychiatric illness, you can be sort of deconditioned. You know, you might have been spending a lot of time on the sofa or in your bed, and you need to start going through more than just the motions of life, but actually engaging in life activities and starting to enjoy things again. So the idea of from survive to thrive is that even though you have a psychiatric problem, once it starts getting better, you can actually start building the tools and the activities into your day so that you can lead the fullest life possible.
Let's talk about the tools and activities. And maybe before we get to that, what would you tell those people who are like, yeah, I'm really struggling right now and I feel defeated. I don't feel like things will not improve. What do you tell someone in that place?
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing about most psychiatric problems are they're highly treatable. And so the main goal in treatment is to keep surviving from one day to the next until you can get fully better. Now, you know, there's different ways to define recovery. Some people are looking for symptom recovery, of course, so that they're no longer feeling sad or listless. The other aspect of recovery is functional recovery. People want to be able to work, say, or fulfill their role as a partner. And then there's also a recovery of, in the sense of recovery of meaning and purpose in one's life. So there's all kinds of stages of recovery. And some people have such severe illness that they might not get full functional recovery or full symptom recovery if they have some illness, say like schizophrenia or traumatic brain injury or something like that. But for most psychiatric illnesses, you can experience full symptom recovery, full functional recovery, and also recovery of meaning and purpose in one's life. So the main goal when I talk to someone is giving them hope that they're going to get better. And as they're slowly getting better, to keep them going from one day to the next.
You say that in order to flourish, we need to take action. And this seems like this is going to relate to the tools that you mentioned. So how can we take action in order to work towards that place, especially if you feel like you're in the dark, there's no way you're going to feel better. You've been feeling pretty terrible for a while now. How can we take action?
Yeah. So, you know, this is a theme of the book is that, there are more things that we have control over than we often think we do. When you're in a severe depression, say, there are very few things that you can do to get yourself well. But one of the things is that you can try to actually be in bed and sleeping. I know sometimes it's very difficult when you're depressed, but to actually to force yourself to get up during the day is really important, to be awake when it's light outside, to get some sunshine. So that's having your schedule as much as possible relate to daylight is really helpful. Avoiding alcohol and drugs when you're depressed is something that you can do that will actually help you get well and stay well. So there's, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do when you're severely depressed, but if you can force yourself to have a little bit of sunlight, a little daily exercise in the morning is helpful, and to avoid alcohol and drugs. Those are a few things that you can do. And then as you're, contemplating getting into treatment, certainly seeking treatment, taking responsibility for your illness in that way, working with your therapist or your doctor to take medication or engage in cognitive behavioral therapy, the homework that's involved with that. Those are the sorts of things that you can do to take action.
Those are physical actions, right? Like moving into the world. What kind of self-talk could someone in this position have with themselves?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of engaging in therapy, whether it's therapy with a professional or whether you're using a handbook or something like that, is, practicing various techniques. And those can be cognitive behavioral techniques where you learn to identify sort of automatic negative thoughts and talk back to those thoughts. So that's something that one can do. Dialectical behavioral therapy recommends that when you have a feeling that you observe it, that you don't try to alter it in any way, and that you just observe it and let it pass. So that's another technique. There's lots of techniques that you can do either on your own or with the help of a therapist that can help shift your mindset and shift your feelings.
Before we continue on, we're going to take a short break to tell you about our sponsors. When you work full-time, have kids, and run a podcast, it's hard to make time for a multiple-step skincare protocol. That's why I'm excited to tell you about today's sponsor, OneSkin. Their products make it easy to keep your skin healthy while looking and feeling your best. Let me repeat it. They make it easy. No complicated routine, just simple, scientifically validated solutions. If you're looking for skincare products that are simple and effective, for a limited time, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your first OneSkin purchase when using the code IDO when you check out at oneskin.co. I've been using OneSkin's body lotion for about a month, and I've already seen noticeable improvements with small wrinkles and textures on my skin, specifically on the back of my neck and the back of my hands, two places where I get a lot of sun. Plus, my skin looks and feels healthier all around. It's all thanks to OneSkin's revolutionary OS-01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to deactivate aging cells responsible for lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. Unlike traditional skincare products that only mask symptoms, OneSkin pioneered a new approach, integrating tissue engineering and cutting-edge science to enhance skin biology for lasting resilience against aging. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using the code IDO at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with the code IDO. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support your show and tell them we sent you. Do you want to know one of my favorite meals? It's a slice of toasted bread with tomato, mozzarella, basil, olive oil, salt and pepper, and a little drizzle of balsamic glaze. Makes my heart happy. It's so simple. It's so delicious. And I love that all the ingredients get to show off their individual flavors. I used to eat it all the time as my easy go-to meal. And then all of a sudden, there was a ton of messaging out there telling me that I shouldn't eat carbs and that I shouldn't eat bread and that bread is bad. And I hate to admit it, but I cut out bread entirely for the longest time. And it wasn't until recently that I started to understand that not all bread is created equal. Hero Bread makes those same delicious favorites free of consequences or compromises. They've remade carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. I highly recommend that you give their bread a try. They're giving Relationship Advice listeners 10% off when you visit hero.co and use the code IDO at checkout. I was so excited to discover Hero Bread. It's truly amazing, and they've made a product that is tasty and soft while having 0 to 1 grams of net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and high in fiber. I'm not going to lie, their white bread is so good, and it makes the best tomato and mozzarella sandwich. Last week, Stella and I were back in Florida visiting our family, and we all walked to the lake, and the only bread we had in the house was Hero Bread. So we grabbed a slice, walked to the lake, and by the time we got there, Stella had eaten the whole piece of bread and, of course, wanted more. So the poor ducks didn't get any Hero Bread, but Stella did. Since I had cut out bread for a while, every time I ate low-quality bread, my body felt bad. It felt bloated, and I didn't feel great. But with Hero Bread, I feel good after eating it, which makes my life so much easier because now I can go back to my easy grab-and-go sandwiches when I'm on the run. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use the code IDO at checkout. That's IDO at HERO.CO.
This seems related to the life story perspective. Can you share a little bit what that's about and how we can use that tool to change the narrative?
Yeah, so just stepping back a bit. So, you know, the way I have been taught and generations of people have been taught at Johns Hopkins to think about psychiatric illness is that there are psychiatric illnesses or psychiatric problems can have different origins. And there's four sort of families that these come in. So one possible origin is in a broken part or function in the brain. So that's the disease perspective. The other possible origin or family of origins is behavioral disorders. So those are things like eating disorders or sexual disorders or substance use disorders. And so they kind of have some similarities that can help inform their treatment. And then the third way of thinking about or explaining psychiatric illness is problems that arise or have their origin in your personality, either your temperament, your affective temperament, how you react to things, or your cognitive capacity in terms of intelligence or attention. And then the fourth kind of origin of psychiatric problems are what we describe as the life story kinds of problems. And these are marked by how you deal with certain events or how you, the story you tell about certain events in your life. So there's a lot of reframing that goes on for problems that are emerging from the life story perspective. So that's, I think that's the question you're asking then, is how the stories that we tell ourselves and how we talk back to thoughts that we're having can help us heal from various psychiatric problems or events that have occurred in our lives. So an example, if somebody, say, is coming with grief, you know, there's a lot of stories that people can tell themselves after the loss of a loved one. They might have survivor guilt, for instance. They might feel like they could have done more to help the person stay well or not pass away. They could feel like they had done something to anger God and that they were being punished by God for this. And that was the reason that their loved one died. There are all kinds of stories people tell themselves. And so being able to think about those stories and reframe those stories into something that's more positive and more adaptive is something that can be done in therapy. Or you can use various self-help techniques to help yourself work through the story, to identify the stories you're telling and to work through those.
Can you walk us through an example? Say I'm seeing you and you're my therapist and I want to rewrite this negative story I have. Let's say it's about my partner in this relationship, and maybe you can give a more specific example of something you've dealt with, but let's try to make it about a relationship and how you would walk someone through re-scripting that story.
Yes. So somebody could be coming to see me because they have had a romantic breakup and they, you know, it came on suddenly to them. They had no idea that this relationship was in jeopardy or was on the rocks. And so they might come and say that they're viewing themselves as sort of a victim of circumstances, and they're having trouble getting over this or understanding, you know, what happened. And so working with someone to see if there's a more adaptive way of interpreting what has gone on is you kind of look at the facts. And so what were the facts? And the facts were that there might have been communication difficulties, and there might have been some red flags that the person who's coming to see me had been ignoring. And so there might be a way to look at what's happened and how they're dealing with them and see, well, actually, you know, there might have been some things that you could have done early on that would have helped protect you against this loss. And so processing things that way with someone, looking back, what are the facts? What's the story they're telling themselves? And then trying to piece things together in a way so that somebody can maybe experience themselves less as a victim, but as somebody who has survived this experience and has learned from it and has seen ways that they can prevent that from happening to them going forward. That's what I mean by sort of re-scripting, reframing. It's looking at the facts, looking at the story, and seeing if there's a way that one can make meaning of what's happened so that they feel more equipped to deal with life and whatever life throws them in the future.
I just started reading a book called The Untethered Soul, and I'm literally like a chapter and a half in, but the whole first chapter, I think it's called The Voice in Your Head, and it breaks down this narrative in a great way, and it was really valuable for me, and you're touching on it, but it's looking at the facts. And when you start to pay attention to that narrative we have, and we do it all day throughout the day, a lot of us, and you start to realize how often it is not true. Like, we're anxious about something, or we're telling ourselves a story about our partner, and they're doing this, and they're making us angry, and it's all about them and how they wronged us and all these things. Or it could be something as simple as just observing the world, and we're not present, and you start to pay attention to that voice, and it's just constantly going, and how often it's not true. Like,
exactly,
it's just not even in a bad way. It can be an objective thing that you're observing the world, and we're not getting to the reality of the situation because we're conditioned through our upbringing, through our genetics, our biology, and we're telling this narrative that's just, it's not really helpful. And like you said, a breakup is a perfect example. We're heartbroken, and we'll tell ourselves stories. Maybe we'll get angry at the other person. They did this and they wronged me, or what could have been this and that. And it's like, wait, let's just pause for a second and try to be super objective. Look at the facts, and you'll start to realize that almost, I found just in this brief time that I've read this exercise and you're alluding to it, that it's often not even close to the reality. And then we can kind of regain control of our lives instead of the voice in our head dictating just where we're going. And it's often a negative place that's just not the reality.
Yes. I mean, human beings are really hardwired to tell stories. And there's great experiments that have been designed that show that we'll tell stories in the absence of any evidence to support those stories. We will make up stories to support evidence that is not true, that somebody presents to us. And then alternatively, and more commonly, we make up stories and ignore the evidence, and the stories cloud that. So what happens is that, you know, just think of all kinds of examples, worries that we might have about something we did or something we're going to do. So much of that is just stories. And if you break it down and say, you know, look, what are the facts? And I think a good therapist really does that. They'll say, they'll listen to the patient's story, and then they'll say, okay, let's see, you know, these are interpretations of various things that have happened. What are those things that have happened? And are there other ways of interpreting them? And obviously in a breakup or something like that, we're usually very biased. And so helping people become aware of their own biases, try to peel the emotion away and be able to say, okay, really, what happened? And some things you might never be able to understand why they happened, but some things, you know, you can start making sense of once you see the facts and the the you know, body of evidence, so to speak. And you can learn from that. So I do think, you know, we're storytelling creatures, and sometimes those stories work to our advantage and help us heal and grow. And other times stories are really holding us back. The stories we tell them ourselves or stories that other people are telling about us. And being able to see what the facts are, I think really helps us be able to get rid of those stories that aren't helping us and move forward and open up new possibilities for ourselves.
What's the evolutionary adaptation that has led us? You said we're wired this way. Why are we doing this to ourselves?
Well, I don't know. That's a very big question. I mean, I don't know if there is a theory of why we are making meaning. Most likely evolutionarily, I'm not an expert in this. I'm just speculating that it would be connected to language development and the fact that, you know, we are, you know, language certainly and communication certainly helps us survive. And, you know, as there's evolutionary advantage to language. So I think part and parcel of language is, you know, the capacity to tell stories. And again, I don't think it's evolutionarily advantageous to tell untrue
right.
stories, but I think that perhaps is a side effect of the ability to use language and to tell stories, is that you're going to tell some stories that are be wonderful and then other stories that in some situations aren't going to help us.
Earlier, you mentioned temperament, and you say in your book that we can't change our temperament. So can you share what our temperament is, why we can't change it, but how we can understand it and maybe move through the world better with that understanding?
Yeah. So affective temperament is sort of how you react to different situations. And there's this five-factor model of temperament that's pretty widely accepted that is called the NEO, stands for neuroticism, extroversion, and openness. The first three factors of the five factors. And then there's also agreeableness and conscientiousness. And so basically these are measurable, graded aspects of your personality, just like height or, you know, hair color, for instance, can be aspects of your physical being. These are traits that you have that pretty much don't change throughout your life. There's evidence that some of these can be predicted from infancy, some of these adult traits. But once you're adult, they're pretty much set. And so neuroticism that refers to how strongly you feel things. And then extroversion, introversion relates to whether you're a very present focused person or you're more past and future focused. That's for the latter is for introverts. And then there's openness as well as agreeableness and conscientiousness. So those are the five factors. So basically these are stable throughout your adulthood. I've taken these tests 30 years apart and they've been pretty much identical. So you can't really change who you are. And these affective temperament traits aren't necessarily good or bad. If you're on the extreme, you're going to have more problems than somebody who's more towards the middle of one of these graded traits. If you think of it sort of as a bell-shaped curve for every one of these traits, you're someplace on that curve of neuroticism. And if you're right in the middle, you're probably going to have less problems than if you're on either end of that bell-shaped curve. But wherever you are, it's not necessarily a good or bad thing, because sometimes it's good in certain situations to be a certain personality, and other situations it can be problematic. So everybody is someplace on each of these five bell-shaped curves, and knowing what your temperament is can be really helpful in understanding why you're reacting to things a certain way. So you can't change your natural inclination, but you can change how you respond to the various stimuli or provocations that cause you to react. And so you can change how you think about an event, and you can also change how you act in response to an event. So for instance, I happen to be pretty neurotic, which means I feel things really strongly. And I know that about myself. Like, my feelings can change really, can be very strong. And so I can get very angry, or I can get very sad, or very happy. But if there's a situation where it might be better not to react so strongly, I know that I feel that way, but I can say, put a little brake on how I respond or react, so that, somebody might not know I'm extremely angry because I feel that, I notice it, but then I say, no, I'm not going to let it show, or I'm going to talk back to that and say, look, this is going to pass. This is not a big deal. So there are, we feel how we feel. There's not much controlling that, but we have a lot of control over how we talk back to our feelings and how we control our reactions to our feelings.
Before we continue on, we're going to take a short break to tell you about our sponsors. Hey, Love Tribe, I just want to ask you a few questions. I want to know why you guys are here. Are you here because you want to stop bickering with your partner? Do you want to feel truly heard? Are you looking for ways to reignite your sex life? Or do you want to feel more emotionally connected with your partner? And let's not forget about the fun. Do you long for those fun, giggly moments at the beginning of your relationship? Over the last decade of hosting this podcast with Chase, these have been our top questions. And we get it. We've been there. And that's why we created Spark My Relationship course, because we wanted to put the tools to unlocking a fulfilling relationship right in your hands. So we're offering this course, Spark My Relationship, for only $100 until April 6th. In less than 90 days, this self-paced course will help you create more passion, improve your communication, and build a stronger, more intimate connection with your partner, all while having fun doing it. We've collaborated with over 15 psychologists and therapists to bring you the strategies that marriage therapists teach their clients. This offer is only going to last until Saturday, April 6th. So head on over to our website, sparkmyrelationship.com, and use the code FLASH24 at checkout to get the course for only $100. That's nearly 60% off, and it won't last. The sale ends April 6th. That's sparkmyrelationship.com and use the code FLASH24 to get our course for only $100. Hey, Love Tribe. I have just a few questions for you. I want to know why you are here listening to the podcast. Are you here because you want to stop bickering with your partner and you want to feel truly heard? Or are you looking for ways to reignite your sex life? Or do you want to feel more emotionally connected with your partner? Or do you just long for those fun, giggly moments of connection that you used to have at the beginning of your relationship? Well, over the last decade of hosting this podcast, those were the main reasons people tuned into the show. And we get it. We've been there. So we created our course, Spark My Relationship, because we wanted to put those tools to unlocking a fulfilling relationship right in your hands. We're offering $100 off our course, Spark My Relationship, which is a self-paced course designed to help you create more passion, improve your communication, and build a stronger, more intimate connection with your partner and have an amazing time doing it. We've collaborated with over 15 therapists and psychologists to bring you the strategies that marriage therapists teach their clients. So to unlock this special offer of our course, our listeners can visit sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock to get $100 off. That's sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock.
That's such a powerful, big, and important idea. Understanding that we have a temperament and that we didn't really choose it, which is a whole interesting philosophical conversation in itself, thinking mm-hmm. free will and things like that, but that we can understand it and not be at the mercy of, let's say, our anger or our shyness or all these different things. And obviously in relationships, this is super important. And we're not taught it. We're not taught it growing up as adults a lot of times. And it's so valuable to understand, oh, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in partnerships, it's really important because often we're attracted to partners who are sort of our opposite on these temperament scales. So it's really important if, you know, you're somebody who reacts really strongly to things and you're partnered with somebody who reacts very weakly emotionally to things, you might think that they're, you know, don't care or are, you know, not hearing you or understanding you, but they're, you know, wired a different way and they're not going to be showing their emotions because they are not feeling them that strongly. And again, it's not that one is bad and another is not bad. I mean, if you're a poet, it's really great to have strong emotions. If you're, you know, you want to be able to tap into those feelings and have a depth and strength of feeling that will allow you to express yourself artistically. If you're, you know, an actor, you're going to want to be able to feel things strongly so that you can translate those on stage. You know, if even in something more mundane, if you feel things really strongly, that might mean you worry about things. And if you have a lump that's worth worrying about on your, you know, skin, you're going to go get it checked out. Whereas somebody who's really low on feeling, they might have a lump or bump on their skin that they should really be worrying about and get checked out. But they're like, they don't really feel that worried about it. So they're not going to go for help. So, you know, it's not like being low on neuroticism or high on neuroticism is good or bad. In certain situations, it's going to be helpful. In certain situations, it's going to be harmful.
Why are we attracted a lot of times to opposite temperaments?
Well, I think people are looking for some completion, you know, somebody that completes them, somebody that complements them, that balances them. You know, if somebody, for instance, with extroversion and introversion, it's really sort of a classic example of, you know, somebody who's shy might be attracted to somebody who's a little more gregarious, and that helps them get out in the world and, you know, helps them grow. They might not change, or they're not going to change from being a shy introverted person to being an extroverted person, but they're going to be able to enjoy the rewards that come with being a slightly more gregarious extroverted person, because they're going to be, you know, introduced to more people, more activities. They're going to be around somebody that's more the life of the party than they are. So people can enjoy that even if it's not their natural inclination. And they really seek that out as a way of rounding out themselves and their lives.
And how can that create issues? Obviously, you know, it's going to do that. But what are some examples, and how can someone think about it? Because I know I've been in situations where, yeah, like it's the same thing that has attracted me to a partner, but then can also be, I guess, negative.
Oh, yeah. I can create conflicts.
Yeah. And for me, I guess I interject here and say what was helpful is understanding that there is no perfect partner. And the idea is not to be perfect, in that it's accepting the imperfections of our partner, you know, and I have imperfections too, and understanding that obviously it's a two-way street, in that we are both accepting those imperfections and growing together. And that's the whole dance, right?
Right. Well, you know, we'll take the example of extroversion and introversion. So, you know, there may be a time when somebody who's more introverted is going to say, you know, I can't go out again this week. You know, it's too draining to me. And being able to know yourself and know that a little bit of that is going to help push you out of your comfort zone, you know, a little bit of going out. But there's, you have a limit. And, you know, for the extrovert, being with somebody who's more introverted might help them because it might, they might say, you know, I want to stay home tonight. You know, we've gone out three times this week. And the extrovert might actually learn something about themselves by being able to sit with themselves for a little bit and or with their partner that that evening instead of going out. So I think there's a lot to be, you know, learned as we learn about ourselves. There's a lot to be learned about, you know, how we might grow by negotiating these relationship issues in a give and take way. You know, you're giving up something that you would have normally done, but you're gaining something by experiencing something that you're not naturally inclined to experience. You know, the classic example of conflicts that come up are with people who are high conscientiousness, who are in a relationship with somebody who's low conscientiousness. So, you know, if you're low on conscientiousness, that means that, you know, you have a tendency not to follow through on promises that you've made. You know, so you might, somebody might say, or, you know, let's plan on going out on X night. And, you know, the more conscientious person in the relationship will expect that there will be follow through, that you will actually be going out that night. And the low conscientiousness person might have said, oh, you know, yeah, I made other plans, or I didn't write that in my calendar. I didn't think that, I thought that was just an option. I didn't know we had decided on it. And so that can be conflicts there. There can be conflict over something as mundane as, you know, picking up your socks. You know, you said you were going to pick up your socks. You didn't pick up your socks. You never pick up your socks. You can see how this plays out in relationships. The conflicts between high conscientiousness and low conscientiousness people is some of the more common conflicts that are seen in marital therapy.
Well, Meg, obviously, we could go on for days because we're covering a broad and an important area of really what it means to be a human. And it's a hard thing to navigate through this life. And we want to do it well for ourselves and for our relationships. So I think we covered some good ground here and gave our listeners a lot to think about. Before we wrap up, can you tell our listeners where they could find you online and then maybe something that you'd like to leave them with, and then we'll say goodbye.
Oh, sure. Thanks. So I do have a website. It's Margaret Chisholm, chisholmmd.com. And basically a website for the book. You can order the book from there. There's a link to Amazon and other places where the book can be found. So they can get in touch with me that way. I guess, you know, my main aim in writing the book was, it was twofold. One was I really wanted to demystify psychiatric problems. So everybody has a mental life, and sometimes our mental life can go awry. And that means that we might have feelings that we're not used to experiencing or we find problematic. We might have thoughts that are concerning, or we might be behaving in ways that are concerning. So when things are, when our life's not going the way we expected it to go, it's often because of problems with our feelings, thoughts, or behaviors. And one of my goals was just to demystify these problems in that way and help people understand that these problems can have various origins and kind of work through those possibilities. So that was one aim of the book. And the other aim was to de-stigmatize these problems. So again, everybody has a mental life, just like everybody has a physical body. And just as the things can go wrong with the physical body, things can go wrong with our mental life. And those problems part of being human and are nothing to be ashamed of. And they just need to be spoken about and addressed in a way so that people don't have to be debilitated by these problems.
Well, that is important for everyone out there listening to understand. And yeah, you're not alone. They're human problems. So thank you so much, Meg. I really appreciate it. We'll have the links in the show notes and on our website at idopodcast.com. And thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you guys so much for tuning into today's episode. As always, all the links to the guest, as well as any of their recommendations, will be in the show notes page. You can find the link to that in the episode description or by going to idopodcast.com. Click on the podcast tab up at the top and you will have access to all the episodes that we've ever done. There are over 300 of them. And while you're on our website, if you haven't checked out our free 14-day Happy Couple Challenge, we really hope you do. It's a free email challenge that we send to you. It's 14 days of fun, easy, doable challenges to help strengthen and improve your relationship. And if you're looking for something that provides a little more help with working on your relationship, whether it's improving intimacy or communication with your partner, or just bringing the spark back, we would love for you guys to check out our online course, Spark My Relationship. We're offering $100 off to all of our listeners if you go to sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. We've worked with over 15 psychologists and therapists to create the real life tools and strategies that they are teaching their clients. So we wanted to give them to you. It's a self-paced online course that can be done in as little as a month or up to 3 months. You can really decide how much or how little you want to do with your partner or maybe just yourself. So we hope you guys check that out. It's sparkmyrelationship.com/unlock. Have a great day.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.